Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll listen back to my conversation with Iowa's very own BMX mama, Kitty Weston-Naur. But first, on Friday, a new play will be read in public for the first time. It's called My Daughters Are My Writings, and it's inspired by the stories of seven different Sudanese Iowans and the book Modern Muslims, a Sudan memoir by Stephen Howard. It gives us insight into the people behind a movement called the Republican Brotherhood. The play will be read on Friday at 4:30 in the Senate chambers of the Old Capitol Museum in Iowa City, and followed by a talk given by Howard. And this hour, we'll learn about the stories behind the play. Playwright Margot Conley and the University of Iowa graduate students who carried out interviews with Sudanese Iowans will be here in just a few minutes. But first, Stephen Howard is the author of Modern Muslims, a Sudan memoir. He's with us on the line. Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here.
I'm happy to join you.
And I think that the history of the Republican Brotherhood is one that very few people listening right now are going to be familiar with. I certainly wasn't familiar with it. So let's go back in time to the early 1980s. First of all, what took you to Sudan?
I was on a trip to do the research for my doctoral dissertation from Michigan State. And I'm a sociologist, and I had been a Peace Corps volunteer next door in Chad. And I decided I liked that region, which is why I chose to go to Sudan. I was also interested in learning more about the mystical aspect of Islam known as Sufism, and I can talk more about that as well. And so as I landed in Sudan and started to look for a place to live, I also was trying to find a Sufi organization that would take me in and let me observe and be part of whatever they were about. And I was a young man on a mission, and that was sort of the basic outline of my my first trip to Sudan.
And when did you encounter the Republican Brotherhood?
As I was looking for a place to make this connection with Sufism, a friend of mine who I'd known from the U.S., who was also working at the University of Khartoum, told me about this wonderful kind of Sufi poetry element of the organization, and that I should go and listen to them some evening, and I managed to do so, and it turned out to be Mahmoud Muhammad Taha and his followers, known as the Republican Brotherhood, the Republican Brothers and Sisters, and they were having what's called a zikr, which means remembrance, remembering God, and this is something they would do every Thursday evening, every Friday, and Thursday is the beginning of the weekend in many Muslim countries, the day before Friday. And so I was fascinated and literally entranced, and I said, this looks like a great organization to be part of. They were progressive and kind of Western-oriented, and they had no objection to my hanging out, and so I did, and so that's within 3 or 4 months of my arriving in Sudan, I found this group, and that became kind of the story of my life.
So let's talk more about what the Republican Brotherhood stood for. I mean, you entered, I guess, looking for poetry and insight into religion, but what were the principles that were guiding this organization?
They had been established from the 1940s during Sudan's quest for independence Mahmoud Mahmatah, who had been trained as an engineer, got involved with politics because he saw that Sudan needed a strong group of people to guide it into becoming a republic. So he founded something called the Republican Party, and its essence was to move Sudan away from British colonialism and into being on its own as a sovereign state, as the Republic of Sudan. And as his mission to get into politics kind of got overwhelmed by bigger parties in Sudan, he retreated from politics and converted his political movement, which had had an Islamic thrust to begin with, into a contemplative sort of organization to rethink the role of Islam in modern society. And he had spent 2 years in a spiritual retreat, you know, isolated from everybody in his hometown. And he emerged from this retreat around 1950 with this idea that the way that people should understand the Quran, the essential text of the faith of Islam, is to pay close attention to the earliest revelations from God to the Prophet Muhammad, and those were largely signaling a world of peace, of justice, of equality between men and women, of equal status of everyone in society, of a peaceful relationship between all people of faith. And it was a very positive kind of message that came out of the early revelations of the Quran. And Ustaz Mahmoud, or Teacher Mahmoud, as he was known, decided to make this kind of a social movement and began to speak publicly about it and write in newspapers and so forth about his ideas. And he slowly attracted a following and went on a speaking tour around the country, all over Sudan, which at that time was Africa's biggest country. And he attracted a small following of very devoted people to kind of practice what he was preaching. And they set up various institutions, and that was sort of the beginning of the movement.
You mentioned equality between men and women. At that time, at that moment in Sudan, was that considered to be very radical?
Kind of, yeah. I guess I'd always say that women are respected members of Sudanese society, but at the same time, there is this sense, as a country with not too much in the way of educational possibilities for men or women, particularly at that time, that women were not particularly encouraged to become educated, or be good Muslims. Sort of the atmosphere was one where kind of Islamic orthodoxy was the realm of men, and women were considered to be, well, you know, they're Muslims too, but it's not as important that they pray five times a day, or that they fast for Ramadan and do the other elements of Islam that your basic observant Muslim would do. Women were considered to be kind of part of the folkloric elements of Islam. They enjoyed the singing and the practice of a women's cult called Zar. That was a very common thing in Sudan, where women would engage in mystical kinds of predictions and read tea leaves and coffee grinds and so forth to make predictions about the future. So, in other words, it wasn't an orthodox kind of practice in terms of women. So Mahmoud, though, was saying, hey, women are Muslims as well as men, and that society can't function properly if 100% of the community is not joining in the practice of Islam. So he encouraged women to study the Quran, to get an education, to be part of his movement, to attend his meetings, to learn about, to read and study the Quran very thoroughly, and to be fully engaged in the leadership of his movement, too.
Now, you mentioned that he developed a small following, but this organization came into conflict with the government of Sudan, which meant the end for the leader of the organization. Tell me what happened.
Well, throughout its history and throughout Ustaz Mahmoud's leadership of this organization, he constantly was in conflict with the so-called Islamic authorities in the country, and he was regularly denounced from the pulpits of mosques at Friday prayers and so forth. And several times in his life, I think maybe five or six times, he was brought to trial for Islamic offenses such as blasphemy or apostasy or heresy. And he managed to be acquitted all of those times. But this was throughout the 60s and the 70s. And finally, in 1983, the then president of Sudan, Jafar Nimeiry, imposed what his version of what he called Islamic law or Sharia. And the Republican Brotherhood thought that this was very inappropriate for a country that was not 100% Muslim. About 30-40% of the people in Sudan were Christians or practitioners of various African religions.
And we're going to have to pick up this story in just one moment. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back. I'm talking with Stephen Howard, author of Modern Muslims, a Sudan memoir. And his book, along with interviews of Sudanese Iowans, has inspired a new play. It's called My Daughters Are My Writings, and it will be read in public on Friday. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're learning about the story behind a new play called My Daughters Are My Writings. The story, or the play, will be performed in a staged reading for the first time on Friday at 4:30 at the Old Capitol Museum in Iowa City. And the play was inspired not just by the book Modern Muslims, a Sudan memoir by my guest Stephen Howard, but also by interviews with seven different Sudanese Iowans. And in just a moment, the graduate students who performed those interviews are going to join us. Also, playwright Margot Conley, behind the play, will be here as well. But Steve, we need to finish what we were starting in the last segment of the show. We were just talking about the very difficult events that led up to what happened in 1985, when the leader of the Republican Brotherhood was executed.
Right. Yes. And I was saying that he and his followers came into conflict with the government, which had was imposing their version of Islamic law, and the Republican Brotherhood objected to trying to impose something like this on a big multicultural, multi-religious society like Sudan, and so they started to speak out against it. And over the course of a couple of months, about 70 brothers and sisters were arrested, including Mahmoud Mohammed Taha, and they were taken to prison. And at the end of close to 18 months of detention, they were released. I guess it was more than 18 months, in fact, but they were released towards the end of 1984, but immediately started speaking out against the Islamic law and arrested again, and particularly Ustaz Mahmoud was brought to trial and accused of the capital offense in Islam of apostasy, which is literally going back on one's religion. And so it was a kangaroo court. There were trumped up charges, and Ustaz Mahmoud did not have a defense except for his own words. And within 3 days of the trial, the court condemned him to death. And on Friday, which is usually the day of executions in Muslim societies, he was a 76-year-old man, was hanged by the neck in front of a enormous crowd of people, and that was January 18th, 1985.
What happened to the Republican Brotherhood after his death?
Well, initially, many, many, many of the brothers and sisters were put in detention themselves as well, fearing that they would continue to these protests, but then they were released, and in fact, 76 days after the execution of Ustaz Mahmoud, the government of Jafar Nimeiri, the president who had executed him, was overthrown in a popular revolt, which the Sudanese called Intifada, an uprising, and an interim government was imposed, which led to free elections. And unfortunately, that government was overthrown in 1989, in June of 1989, and this government has ruled Sudan for the past 30 years. So they've been essentially the same kind of government as executed Ustaz Mahmoud, but this government has tried to have closer relations with the U.S. and has eased off a bit in terms of imposing restrictions on parties like the Republicans, but nevertheless, there's a heck of a lot of oppression in Sudan, and the country is currently in a state of revolt once more, and particularly young people are very, very anxious to see regime change in a place where 60% of the population has never known a president other than Omar Bashir, who's been ruling since June of 1989.
I'm talking with Stephen Howard, author of Modern Muslims, a Sudan memoir. His book, along with interviews with Sudanese Iowans, is the basis of a new play called My Daughters Are My Writings. And now I want to bring into the conversation Margot Conley. She is the playwright behind this play and a graduate of the University of Iowa MFA Playwriting Workshop. Hello, Margot.
Hi.
And also the other people involved in this cooperative. Niyari Chisaka is a graduate student in the history department at the University of Iowa. Niyari, welcome.
Thank you.
And also Deason Ndongwe is also a graduate student and a teaching assistant in the history department at the University of Iowa. Deason, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Margot, I want to ask you, I mean, we've gotten the background here from Stephen Howard. How did this partnership come about, turning this story, one that many Americans don't know very much about, although there are many Sudanese people living in the state of Iowa, and I'm sure many of the people who have come here from Sudan know this story, but how did it come about that you, along with our graduate students here, came into a partnership to develop a play based on this story?
Well, I was approached by the University of Iowa, the Office of Outreach and Engagement, because I had done a similar project a couple of years ago, taking research from the history department and making a play about the desegregation of schools in Keokuk. So they approached me with, you know, sort of an outline from the interviews that were done, and they pointed me towards Stephen Howard's book. to sort of look at if I was interested in working on the play. And I was, you know, really drawn to this story. I also had never heard about it, and I just was sort of immediately, you know, pulled in.
Well, Niari and Deason, Niari, I'll let you go first. How did you get involved in the Department of History? How did you get involved in collecting these oral histories and doing these interviews?
Yes, well, with me, it was my supervisor, actually, who told us about this project. And through the Office of Outreach and Engagement as well, we started going about talking to these people.
All right. And Deason, you got involved the same way.
Yeah, it was basically the same way.
And the two of you are from Zimbabwe.
Yep.
Had you ever heard about the Republican Brotherhood in Sudan? Was this a new story to you as well?
It was a new story to us as well. We had never heard of them before, definitely.
So when you knew that you were going to interview people to collect information, how did you find the individuals that you would interview about the Republican Brotherhood?
Okay, so our advisor, Professor Giblin, had met one of the brothers who is here in Iowa City. So he introduced us to that Sudanese Republican, and from there we started, you know, he started to introduce us to more Republicans. So that's basically how we ended up talking to all these people. It was actually, yep.
All right. And you talked to seven different individuals?
Yeah.
Men, women, can you give me an idea of the people that you talked to?
We talked to both men and women. Basically, we can say roughly maybe three women, right? And the others were men. Yeah.
And when you asked them to share their stories, did you focus just on their affiliation with the Republican Brotherhood?
Yeah, I would say so. But most of the times, we'd simply allow them to tell us their story, right? Then we knew what we're looking for, but we just allowed them to speak the story, to tell us the story. That's what happened.
Given that this was an organization that did come into conflict with the government, that many people were imprisoned and the leader was executed, were people nervous about talking about the Republican Brotherhood with you?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all.
They were actually excited because I think they also wanted their story to be out there. I mean, the world to know their story. So they were excited about it.
Can you tell me something that you learned in one of these interviews that really stays with you?
I would say they are an intellectual movement. And I was fascinated by the way they understand life. They have this idea of everyone being equal. And I think the most fascinating thing was seeing how they treat their wives and how they propagate for equality between men and women. I was blown away by that.
Decent?
Yeah, basically, I would say so myself. I was particularly drawn to the figure of Mahmoud Taha, his way of thinking, and I think Steve Howard has talked about it, like we're talking about the 50s, the 60s, but he had a radical way of thinking, a radical way of looking at life. And I was also inspired by how his, you know, his disciples or his followers who are now here in Iowa City are still religiously following that way of thinking that they were taught back in the day, in the 80s, in the, you know, so that's
still trying to stay true to the teachings.
Yes, and if you meet them, you won't have any doubt. They are the most humble people that I've ever come across.
But it sounds like they're proud of this history.
Exactly. They're very proud of it.
And so, Margo, you read Steve's book. You then got a collection of these interviews. Were you getting transcripts of the interviews that both Niari and Decent conducted?
I had like an outline, and then I got some of the recordings to listen to later on in the process.
So what is the process of taking all of these stories and all of this information and turning it into a play?
Yeah, I think what I was most, I mean, it's because it's so much information, you know, but I think I, you know, similarly, even just from the first outline, was so drawn to this idea of women within the movement and the way that women sort of were able to have ownership over that movement in a way that wasn't common for that time or place. So I was sort of, I used that as sort of a lens through which to look at all the other information and sort of sift in what would, you know, best serve that story.
Your play focuses on the voices of women. So much of our conversation has been about the leader of this movement so far, but it sounds like it was really the voices of these women who were given an opportunity to express themselves intellectually, to participate in their faith in a new way. That's what really struck you, Margot?
Yeah, for sure. Well, because I think what's so, because I also found myself drawn to this, you know, figure of Taha, but I think what I was so drawn to is the way that he really was lifting up these women to have their own voice and their own place. So it sort of is, you know, it feels like it's hard to separate the two because that seems so much of his mission. Yeah.
Right. Well, and I think a lot of people everywhere, not just in the United States, but certainly in the United States, we make some basic assumptions about Islam and about the place of women in the Muslim faith. Margot, what are you hoping that people who encounter your play will take away from it?
You know, I think I'm just really hopeful that people, you know, get a fresh perspective on sort of on the diversity of, you know, stories within the Muslim world, that I do think that we sort of paint this picture of women as subjugated or oppressed. And I think that there's room for these other stories that we just haven't listened to or haven't been able to hear.
Niari, why do you think it's important for people to learn these stories?
I think it's important because this group of people, they're not known that much. Very few people know them. And I think their stories need to come out. I think it's very important that women had such a big relevance within the movement, and they still do right now. So I think that's extremely important.
Yeah, Decent. You were surprised by these stories, weren't you? Did this change your worldview a little bit?
Yep, I would go along what Margot just said. I think I was equally guilty of this stereotyping of the Muslim faith, to think that, you know, women are subjugated and so forth. But coming across this story, yeah, I was changed.
Steve, obviously you have spent a lot of time and energy in making sure that the story of the Republican Brotherhood is being shared and is living on. Why do you think it's important for people to know about this movement and to hear these stories?
Well, what I like about this particular treatment that Margot put together is that there are voices of immigrants to the U.S., obviously the Sudanese in Iowa, and particularly today when we're immigrants to the U.S. are under such pressure and are being attacked from every angle and not seen as people fit to be part of our society and our culture. And yet at the same time, here are, I think what is a great takeaway is to show that these are women who were contributing a great deal to the development of their society, and then they came to the U.S. under some pressure to leave their home country, and they have great skills and talents in being able to behave democratically and be educated members of society and help to develop their families and be community leaders and take on organizing various activities in the U.S. and certainly I think it's exciting that Mazahar Saleh, who's a member of the Iowa City Council is a Sudanese woman. She's not a Republican sister, but nevertheless, she comes to the U.S. in this wave of migration from Sudan to the U.S., and she's one of the few Muslim elected officials in the state of Iowa, and she's making a remarkable contribution to our society as well.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for talking with me today.
I'm very happy to do so. Thanks for asking.
Stephen Howard, author of Modern Muslims, a Sudan memoir. Nayari Chisaka, thank you.
Thank you.
And Decent Ndongwe, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
The graduate students who carried out the interviews with Sudanese Iowans that are the basis for this play. Margot Conley is the playwright behind the play. It's called My Daughters Are My Writings. Margot, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And there will be a staged reading of the play My Daughters Are My Writings Friday at 4:30 at the Old Capitol Museum in Iowa City, followed by a talk given by Stephen Howard, author of Modern Muslims, a Sudan memoir. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa. With me now is Kitty Weston-Nauer. She's a retired school principal from Des Moines, but she's known worldwide for her skills on her bike. She has been competing in the BMX bike racing circuit for 29 years and has been participating and winning for many, many, many of those years. She is with me now. Hello, Kitty.
Good morning, Charity. How are you?
Great. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And we've talked about this once before, but I want to go back in time to when you first got interested in BMX bike racing. You were, what, 40 years old at the time, right?
Yes, I was. My son said to his dad and he said to me, if you think this is so easy, why don't you try it? And that's how I got involved.
So your son had been racing. How long had he been part of it?
He had been racing now for 2 years. And we had just been racing the Iowa circuit. We had 7 tracks in Iowa from 2 different sanctioning bodies. And we were now progressed to a national. And our son had done extremely well. And this was over in Rockford, Illinois. And you know how, as parents, you know, soccer moms, soccer dads, football, what have you, so we stand on the sideline and talk about what our kids should be doing and telling them that. And we had never been out on the track. So with that challenge, I got involved in the sport of BMX racing.
Now, when you gave it a try, what did you learn?
I learned that I didn't know a whole lot about BMX racing, that's for sure. My very first race was a Mother's Day race in Marion, Iowa, and I borrowed my son's helmet, his gloves, and his bike, all of which were too small for me because, mind you, he was only 11. But I got out there with the other moms. I didn't win that race, but I had a whole different look at what BMX racing was about and a whole lot more respect for the youth and men who had been racing.
Well, and you say, and men who had been racing. It was a very male sport nearly 30 years ago. Still pretty male heavy, I believe.
It is pretty male heavy, but we do have a lot more women who are involved in this sport.
So when you started, I mean, there were very few women involved in the sport. What was that like?
Well, here's the thing. We had girls who raced the 20-inch bikes. And then we had, of course, we had lots of guys, boys and men, who were racing both 20-inch and cruiser. And when I was given that challenge, I decided I would ride the cruiser, which is a 24-inch wheel bike, basically because it was much like my mountain bike in terms of frame size. Well, hey, there in my class, which was 41 to 45, there was one other woman. She raced because her son was racing.
One other woman in the United States?
Yes.
So just the two of you.
Yeah, in our class, because we were broken up into classes. And so we raced, we had to race with the men because there was no women's class. You know, as I continued to do this, women said, I would love to do that, but I don't want to race against the guys. For me, that wasn't an issue because I wanted to race. And I actually raced against my husband because we were the same age.
So he got involved too.
Oh, yeah. The challenge was given to both of us, not just to one or the other of us by our son. Yes.
So for people who've never seen a BMX bike race, tell us what it's like.
You are looking at a track that has a starting gate, and up to a total of 8 people at the most can be on that gate at one time. That starting gate has a downward slope, and you take off from that gate, and you will do a total of anywhere from 1,000 to 1,200 to 1,300 feet on a track that has doubles, may have triples. There will be at least 3 banked curves, or as we call them, berms.
And when you say doubles or triples, are you talking about the little hills that kind of send you flying?
Yes. And sometimes those little hills will send you flying. I've learned over the years to not fly over hills.
You know, okay, I'm 42 years old, and I am not a BMX bike racer, but I don't like falling down, and I don't feel like I recover nearly as well when I do fall down as I did when I was younger. So you started this when you were 40 years old.
Correct.
Were you worried about that? I mean, our bodies don't regenerate quite as quickly as they once did.
No, they don't. But that was not my concern. I tell you, I love challenges. We had already done a number of rag brides, so I was always on a bike. And even as a kid, I was always riding my bicycle. Even after I graduated from college, I bought a bike and I used to ride to work. I used to ride to the school that I taught at. So for me, cycling was just fantastic. And I had more than one type of bike. So, yes, I was doing the mountain biking. I was doing the road bike. I even did some racing. And so when this new challenge came along, it just kind of fell into line with what I was already doing.
Now, I mentioned there weren't a lot of women involved.
No.
How about diversity? Was it a fairly diverse sport, or you were pretty rare as an African-American family involved in this?
I was rare, very rare. There were African-American males, boys, and men. But in terms of women at the time, I didn't see anyone else. Sometimes you would see girls, and by girls I mean under age of 18 who were riding the 20-inch. It is still rare to see African-American women. And it's not like I haven't tried, because one of the things I was able to do was to work with both of our sanctioning bodies, along with men, who said women should have their own cruiser class. And so we went from the handful of women to now we have hundreds and hundreds of women who race cruiser class. They are also racing the 20-inch class. So it's not just girls who are racing now, but women. But in terms of African-American women, we are just not there yet. When I say a handful, I mean that literally.
Have you encountered bigoted ideas because of that, because you're part of this world where you are rare?
You know, with cycling, that has not been the issue as it may have been with other sports. Basically because in the first place, there were few women who were racing cruisers to begin with. It was more, the bigotry was more in terms of, why are you women out here doing this, as opposed to why are you as an African-American woman out here doing this?
So you were too busy battling sexism.
Exactly. and you know, in some cases that may still be the case in some areas. I have not experienced it. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that that I have said to people, you know what? This is a sport that I love. This is a sport that I support. This is a sport where I want it to be all inclusive. And I've done all kinds of things to make sure that that happens.
What keeps you out there competing? Because, I mean, right now you're the oldest.
Mm-hmm. I'm the oldest female in the United States.
Female racer in the United States.
Yes. Right. Yeah. What keeps me out there? Here's the thing. We are living longer lives. And women especially. And what I want to find myself doing, what I want to be able to do, is to know that there's quality in my life. And this sport provides that for me. You know, it's not just about getting on the bike and riding, but now I find myself in the gym. And I'm in the gym because I'm continually having to continue to develop my core strength and my core stability.
Now, what's your training like? How do you stay ready for this? And I know you're recovering from a broken ankle. So
yes, I am. But you know, the broken ankle is just a temporary thing. What I do when I am not at a national or at a local race at racing, I am in the gym. And in the gym, I am doing a series of exercises that has me truly developing the core. And the core of one's body is so critical because you don't have to be on the bike every day of the week. But what you do have to do is to make sure that you are maintaining that core strength and that core stability. The other thing is, because I've had the hips and knees replaced, I also walk 2 miles at least 5 days a week. And so that really gets me amped up, because I know that with the strength that I have developed, I can get out there and compete with the best of us all.
You've been through knee surgeries and
yes.
hip surgeries.
Yes.
How do you keep going after that? I mean, that's something that for a lot of people, obviously they have to go through that as they grow older with mm-hmm. the knee replacements or mm-hmm. hip replacements. And a lot of people work hard to walk again.
Yes.
And to be mobile.
Right.
Why get back on the bike?
Why not? You fall off the horse, you get back on the horse. Okay. What you tell yourself is that, okay, so bam, I went down. But will that stop me from continuing to do what I do and what I love? And for me, no way. I have always been extremely competitive. I grew up with 5 brothers, 2 who were old and 3 who were younger. And under no circumstances would I ever let them get the best of me. I'm now not competing so much against other women. I'm really competing against myself. And I do that because I want to continue to enjoy what life brings to me. You know, the knees and the hips, arthritic. And we go through that. But the other side of that coin is those can be easily replaced. And you go through whatever you have to go through in terms of getting yourself back to where you want to and where you need to be. And so that's what I have done. And I continue to make sure that I am at my healthiest. The other thing also has to do with nutrition and knowing that eating the proper kinds of foods will also make a difference in your ability to be successful out on that track.
You have said that being a BMX bike racer helped you as an educator,
yes.
too. It helped you
yes.
connect with the kids. What do you think it did for you?
Oh, let me tell you. The students that you work with want to know that you are, quote, a human, okay? You're not just their teacher. You're not just their principal. And I've had these issues. Back in 93, I fell off my bike and broke my neck and ended up paralyzed. And I had to learn how to crawl all over again, how to walk all over again. And I had these conversations with my students. You know, life isn't fair. But let's talk about what one needs to do to get to where you want to be. And I would tell them my story. And some of my students had stories that would make you cry, but I will tell you this. So my students truly appreciated the fact that I could be real with them and help them to understand what they needed to do to become successful. You know, we all have our trials and tribulations, and they understood that. So it's so important. It was so important for my students to understand that I know what it's like to be knocked down and have to get back up again.
You were 40 years old. You were a mom, yep. A working mom when you started this. Think of the women out there in the same position right now, women in their 40s. This is a time with a lot of physical challenges for a lot of women, and time challenges are huge. What would you tell us?
Here's what I'll never forget my mother telling me this, and she always said, you know, Kitty, you need to take care of you first. When you take care of you first, then there will be that time to take care of your family. There will be time for you to continue to do your work. But you must make sure that you take care of you, because if you don't take care of you, no one else will. How can you then provide what you need to for your families? Yes, it was time consuming. You know, there used to be a time I'd be up at 4:30 in the morning, and I'd be down in my basement and I'd be working out. I'd come up and have breakfast with the kids and my husband, and we would go off, the kids to school, I to my job, my husband to his. Lots of volunteer activities I was involved in. I also coached when I was teaching. And, time. But you learn how to take a look at what you are doing and decide what is most important. And then how do I go about making sure all of these things are taken care of? And at the end of the day, I would always ask myself, am I happy with what I have done? And if not, what can I do to make it even better? Retirement is a whole lot easier now. The kids are grown and gone. But as a working mom, I really want to stress, and I do this with women all over the country who I have gotten to know, that don't give up your dream. If this is something you really want to do, find a way to make it work. And you'd be surprised. They are doing it because more and more women are joining our ranks. And they are doing it with their families. And that's what's so cool about this whole thing.
This has been an encore edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Dennis Reese. You can get in touch with us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org by email, or find us on Twitter @Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.